clearly not going to be the subject, rather. We heard, I at least heard several speakers mention the words visualization, and I heard several speakers, maybe even the same, also speak of multidimensionality. And at least one referred to the curse of multidimensionality. And I don't think it's nice to say these things, and I would like to convince you that it sometimes is even a blessing. Anyway, I'd like to say something about visualizing multidimensionality. Oh, yes, and not to forget, and I'm glad you came, Vladimir, because the third thing that really stuck to my mind so far was stealing candy from babies, which Vladimir offered as one of the admonitions. And in the course of this talk, I shall endeavor to show you that it's sometimes not easy to do that. Okay, so let's start with visualization. Whether you're willing to accept that visualization is a discipline or not, it's really quite irrelevant to me. But rather, I think that the objective in visualization ought to be to incorporate our tremendous pattern recognition ability to solve problems. And now, my interest in visualization actually comes from geometry. And in my earlier years, thousands of years ago when I was young, I really enjoyed geometry. And I especially enjoyed the insight that I would get from the interaction of pictures about geometry. So as I proceeded to study in the university, and we learned about multidimensional spaces, and there would be situations where the professor would write an equation on the board, then refer to it as a hyperplane, and another equation, and refer to it as a hypersphere, and yet some more as a hypersurface of some sort, and then proceed to do geometry in quotations. I was having the greatest difficulty because I couldn't see the hyperplane or the hypersphere or pretty much anything else except the equations. And I couldn't possibly understand how people could even claim to be doing geometry without pictures. I mean, I somehow rather thought that it ought to be almost illegal to do that. Of course, that didn't really make much of an impression on anybody else. But I became consumed with a desire of somehow being able to construct, let's call it multidimensional pictures. Something that, in the same sense as we did in geometry, when we had a problem, we could drawings, and at times actually understand some of the properties about the problem. If we could do that for multidimensional problems, multidimensional, be fantastic. So I looked around, and at least in the graphical statistical community, there is such a thing. Lots and lots of people invented very ingenious ways of encoding n-dimensional information on the plane so they could visualize multivariate data. So I looked at those ideas, but it really wasn't what I thought I needed for geometry. So I went to the basics. And to me, the basics were the tremendous idea that we got from René Descartes, the idea of a coordinate system. Really a great idea, but the more I thought about it, I said, well, maybe he led us astray taking the axis orthogonal rather than parallel to each other. Now, let me very quickly add, I have absolutely nothing against orthogonality other than the fact that it uses the plane very fast. But more deeply, in geometry, I think that it's parallelism that's the fundamental notion. Euclid's fifth axiom states that there are lines that have no points in common. Whereas to speak of orthogonality, we need some sort of a notion of angle. So they're really not equivalent. So I said, okay, let's try and do it in parallel. And this is what came up, if I can get a response to this. So I do not know what is your favorite dimension. connection. I honestly believe that each and every one of us is entitled to have a dimension of their own where they can exercise their fantasies. Mine, for reasons that are rather cryptical and we won't go into now, happens to be five. So let's start with five dimensions. And we take five copies of the real line, place them equidistant and parallel to each other, and label them with whatever is appropriate, say x1 to x5. And for good measure, we also superimpose the Cartesian coordinate system xy, so that the first axis is kind of schizophrenic and the bottom is called x1, on top it's called y. Okay, how does it work? Let's take a point in phi space and order quintuple. And it's very simple. We measure the first component on the first axis, second on the second axis, third on the third axis, and so forth. And then to indicate the fact that we want all these guys together to be a single entity associated together, we simply join them with straight lines. And what we have done is we have established a one-to-one mapping between ordered quintuples and polygonal lines whose vertices are on the parallel axis. And by polygonal lines, I really need to take the full line, as we will see, not just the segment between the axes. And there's clearly no loss of information, because from the polygonal line, I can recover the quintuple. And in principle, we can keep on adding axes. Now we speak, we have here many, many problems, lots of dimensions, and I just want to stay, but we will not do it, but perhaps I understand that Peter has offered cognac after 4 p.m. And that would be a wonderful opportunity, which by then, with the help of cognac, we would be sufficiently prepared. And maybe, for anyone's interested, we actually see how this works in countably infinite spaces for those who are interested in truly high-dimensional problems. Okay, anyway, so this is 5D. And in fact, basically almost any reasonable finite D. So I was playing around with this idea, and to my not-so-great surprise, the first community to show serious interest were the people who look at data, multivariate data. So let me show you a couple of examples, and this, I guess, will be some kind of a token portion to data mining, which is one of the titles in the talk, of the workshop. So here I'm showing you a portion, a map, which I'll discuss in a moment. And it's a map, a portion of a nice country in Europe called Slovenia. And I was there, I was working on something else and some economic data, and close to us was a group that had satellite data that happened to be measurements from Landsat. And this creature goes around and measures different emissions. The physics are, first of all, I don't know them and are really irrelevant here. So they wanted to know what, if anything, could be found using this approach. So they gave me a map and measurements of the emissions in the map. I happened to be measuring 7 different emissions. And when I plotted them, it looked like that. So first thing is, please don't let the picture intimidate you. You will see that it's, in fact, useful. OK, so let's make sure that we know what we're looking at. And here's the rectangle. The rectangle that corresponds to the map. OK, so this is our x. Sorry. OK, x is here, y is here. And let's take a single data entry that make sure we understand how it works. So we have a definition of the location, x, and here it is, and y, and here it is. So at this location, we are given 7 numbers, which are here joined to have a polygonal line, and we're now looking at something with 9 variables. So when you put them all together, you get this mess. And the point of this exercise, if any, is to look at the data and to be able to say something about what's on the ground. So let me point out to you this lake with a strange finger there. And I will attempt to draw that lake from the data. that, and it was, I mean, I did it instantaneously, it just happened to look, and it was wonderful to see the reaction of the people who gave it that. How did you do it? I said, well, there are patterns here. I mean, there's a pattern here, and I just isolated. I said, well, what do you mean? I said, I don't know. Well, while they were talking, I started playing around, and I found out you actually can take out the water and put it back. It would be wonderful in some certain situations to be able to do these things, especially with the fires all around. And I could get fancy, and I could draw the coastline there with nice colors, but we're almost going to have time. Anyway, they were very impressed, which really amazed me because it was very easy to spot. And so what I did, I mean, I just, if I may say it in the colloquial, I just let my eyes do the walking. Pattern. What's a pattern? Anything that I think is a pattern. So I just spotted it. And then I played around and I showed them finding rules for the forested regions and what have you. And they were fascinated. But they kept saying, yeah, we can't really do that like you can. Is there some way that you can do? Yes, please.
Wasn't the last example just one segment of one program?
Correct.
Very easy rule.
I just want to start with something, right?
Oh, okay.
But since you were very kind and started the discussion, no, I want to reward you, I mean, to reward you with a very valuable gift. I have more valuable gifts. I did that in a conference in Germany and somebody really got upset with me and I didn't know what else to do, so I gave him another toothpick and he exploded. It's very strange. Okay, yes, this is just one variable, very easy. But we will see lots. I wanted to get stuck. The rule for the forest involves several variables, but if I did it, then we'll have to talk a little on that. Okay, so basically what we did, as you correctly said, is we found a rule, a classification rule, which, as we know, means some conditions on some of the variables which characterize a specific subset of the data. Okay? And I said, is there some way you could do that automatically? Of course, the classifiers, you know that, and you guys talked about it. But I wanted to do my own, I think, geometrically, so I went away and started scratching my head, whatever is left of the hair, and came up with something. And I happened to be visiting some friends, some of them are here, from our group at Yale, or some of them are here. And we, on occasion, collaborate. And I went there and I said, you know, I've been working on a classifier. He says, oh, that's wonderful because we got this data set from the medical school. And they asked us to classify it and we're having trouble. So what is this data set? Here is it. By the way, can I ask you guys to turn these things off? I have a rule in my class, if the cell phone rings during the lecture, the owner of the cell phone buys drinks for everybody. So I don't know if we want to enforce it here, but it's okay, anyway, so they gave me this data set, and they said there are two categories. Just in a few words, they took a poor monkey, and they stuck electrodes in its brain. And the moment I made a face, somebody says, well, it really doesn't hurt. So I said, well, why didn't you do it in yourself if it doesn't hurt? Anyway, that wasn't scoring any points. So they claim that they put the electrodes on two different kinds of neurons. Again, how they do it, I don't know. So that here, the first axis is categorical, has two categories, one and two. One kind of neuron, second kind of neuron. Okay, and then they stimulated the poor monkey, maybe they showed him pictures of Playboy or whatever it takes. And the neurons started firing, and the claim is that they can isolate 32 different pulses and measure the amount. Let me show you an example. So I just pick one of them. So we see here, this is a data item pertaining to the neuron class 2. Pulse of type 1, X1, this amount, X2, this amount, 32. So we have 33 variables altogether. It starts to get respectable. And the good doctors wanted a classification rule so that if they would look at the output, they would see the output of one of the neurons, they could decide with some precision that it's neuron of type 1 or neuron of type 2. And my friends had not been able to come up with a classification rule, and they sent it to some other people, And it was even mentioned that the doctors are starting to make fun of us, something which, of course, we cannot have. So this was, believe it or not, one of the early examples where I tried to classify. So let's do it. I will select all the outputs of neurons of type 1 that will be the input to my classifier. And just to show you that we have an interesting problem, I'm just plotting here the first two variables in the whatever order they do. Okay? So we see they're really quite mixed up. And if you think of classification, something equivalent to separation, even in 2D, it's a challenge. Okay, so now I'll go to classifiers, I'll choose this guy, and apply it. Well, and here's the answer. And it gives me the conditions and the variables, which we can look at, but it's much more fun seeing the rule. What does that mean? Okay. Here's basically the visual output. And the first, I think, interesting aspect is that it finds a very tight upper bound to the rank of the n tuples. Here they're 32, so the dimensionality is 32. So it found that the rank is no more than 9, maybe less, but no more than 9. So we can, in principle, have a basis up to 9, and it chooses, according to a criterion which I'll clarify in a moment, and orders them. So this is what we had from the first two variables in the original display, and this is what the classifier gives. I think we can see it was actually, first of all, it was very interesting, and it was significant because it really helped us understand why the classical ways just didn't do it, because we try to separate clusters with lines, planes, whatever, and clearly even in 2D here this wouldn't work. We have two classes very close to each other, interesting shape. Now this thing actually gives us a roadmap to look at the best cross sections of the hypersurface. Here's some more. And as we go along, we are really going down this sequence. So please notice, as we go along, the separation between the classes becomes less and less. And that's basically the criterion of how it orders them. So it's really nice if you think, at least for me, I think about it geometrically. I had a whole bunch of points in 32-dimensional space. People tend to call them data clouds. I prefer to call them multi-dimensional watermelons. I think it's much nicer, because you really want to grab it, part of the ball around. And it found, it selected a nine-dimensional subspace. Really a nice one. I mean, these two semi-pretzels winding through nine space and found them close. Anyway, so it was a nice rule. People liked it, could see the holes. And of course, the next question is it any good as far as precision? So I'll just do a train and test. You know what that means. I do it in a simple way here. The software enables you to choose whatever percentage you like. Let's choose, say, roughly 2/3 of the data at random, on which the algorithm is going to build a rule and test it on the remaining 1/3. Okay, and that's unusual. It usually does it a little bit better. But okay, so it's got error. It's very fast. You can improve it. And we didn't see parallel coordinates except for the picture, but the parallel coordinates are eternal here in the representation and how the algorithm works. And I'll be happy to discuss that afterwards. Anyone who's interested, I know the people here are interested in classification. But there is nice method to start with. That's first of all, you people are interested in data mining, and also hopefully to grab your interest so that you stay with me for the remaining of the talk in trying to convince you that something possibly useful can come out. So let's proceed. And my suggestion is to actually do and explore some of the geometry. when we look at spaces with parallel chords. So let's start with the plane itself. Okay, so we take the plane. We only need two axes. Take a point. Just apply the rule. First point on the first axis, second point on the second axis. We join them, so a point is represented by a line. So therefore, it's only fair to ask how a line might be represented. So here we have it. We take a line, sample some of the points, and then represent each point in parallel coordinates. So this point gives us a straight line, this point another straight line, blah, blah, blah. And lo and behold, the straight lines intersect at a point. And if they didn't, we wouldn't, at least wouldn't be talking to you. But what is happening, and here is the general situation. If we take a line, say with slope M and intercept B, and take any one of its points over here, they become lines. And recall that we have the xy coordinate system. We can write the equation of these lines in xy, find the point of intersection, and express the coordinates of that in xy. And here they are. Okay, so this is the M, and this is the B. The D is, in a sense, irrelevant. It's just the scale is whatever distance we pick between the axes. So what we have, of course, is duality. We have points mapped into lines, and lines mapped into points. Everything is hunky-dory until somebody notices that there's a problem as M approaches 1. My engineering friends might say that the point blows up. I personally have never seen any exploding points. What happens if you do take the limit property? As M goes to 1, this point goes to infinity, but in a fixed direction. Slope B over D. So that tells us something that we know, that you cannot have a complete duality in the Euclidean plane. You've got to go to the projected plane. That's really what it's saying. So you may want to keep it in your mind. So as you can see, let me also, it's fun to have software that you can illustrate these concepts, at least in class. So, if it works. Okay, so here is a point, and here is the door, okay? And that's one way. The other way, here is actually getting a bunch of points on a line and the corresponding points. But what is nice about these things is if you have a steady hand, you can explore and notice something which people don't talk about a lot, that there's some operational dualities. I'll show that to you better in higher dimensions. It's actually very useful there. But there's a duality, apparently, between translations and rotations. So okay, we'll take that up shortly. Okay, so in 2D, we have a point-to-line duality. But we're talking about doing things in high dimensions. So how would it work there? Well, let's ask ourselves, how would we represent a line, an n-dimensional line, in this way? Well, an n-dimensional line is specified in terms of n minus 1 linearly independent linear equations. It's equivalent to intersecting n minus 1 hyperplanes, which are not parallel. The same thing as a line in three spaces is the intersection of two planes. So you guys know how to play around with the matrices and get them in this bidiagonal form. That's a very useful form because now we can look at the generic equation, which involves two variables. And notice that in the xi minus 1, xi, this is a line. And to mark that, we use subscripts. It's the linear relationship between xi minus 1 and xi. Well, we know what to do with that. We can represent that by a point. The same thing for each one of the equations. In other words, we can represent a line in n dimensions by n minus 1 points, but we have to index them because we have to distinguish the points here that represents the linear relationship between x1 and x2 from this guy and so forth. And let's see that also in interactively, which is fun. So what I'll do, sorry, it's a question now. Somebody stretches, which is a good thing. Good. Very good. So here we are in six space. I violated my rule and went to six space instead of five. Let's take now from the point of view the axiom that says on two points there's a unique line. So here are two points represented by polygonal lines and another one. And what we do is we take the pairwise intersection of the adjacent variables. And there is the point that represents the linear relationship between x1, x2, x2, x3, x3, x4. And notice that it can be anywhere. And if you noticed from the formula that I had in the duality, the horizontal distance of this character actually depends on the slope. And it's a very useful thing to know, because if it's in between the axes, that means the line has negative slope. If it is to the right, it has positive slope between 0 and 1. If it's to the left, it's larger than 1 and n. So here are the equivalent points to the set of equations, okay? N minus 1 points with two indices. And here they are. And also, I want to point out something that's hopefully clear from the picture, that if we have, believe it or not, this, in this case, 5 points tell us everything about the line, really. And also, if we happen to see polygonal lines going through every one of the index points, that tells us that this is represents a point on the multidimensional line. Okay, so far nobody has jumped out of the windows, which is very smart of whoever chose it not to give us a room with windows, especially not on the high floor. Okay. Now one of the things we'd like to do in geometry is to look for intersections. And let's go to 5 space. Now it's very, very unlikely that two lines in 5 space can find each other and collide, but it may happen, and it would be nice to know to spot it if it does. And it's fun. Works as follows. Okay, we're in 5 space. 4 points with 2 indices specify a line. So here are 4 red ones. So we have these 4 red points. Let's say specifying the red line, and we have the 4 blue points specifying another line, the blue line, and we want to see if they may intersect. So we proceed as follows. Take the points with the same subscripts, 1, 2, and 1, 2, and we join them. Then we go to the next pair, 2, 3 with 2, 3. This is guy 2, 3, and we join those. Now 2 is the common subscript between this pair, so we look in the x2 axis. And if these two lines do not intersect the x2 axis at exactly the same point, we can stop the algorithm, the lines don't intersect, that's it. But in this case, they do intersect, and we proceed 2, 3, 3, 4, 3, 4, 4, 5, and that's it, finished. Okay, so the output of the algorithm is this green polygonal line. What is it? Well, by its construction, it is in every one of the red points. And therefore, it represents a point on the red line. And it's also on every one of the blue points. So it represents a point on the blue line. So it's a common point. So not only you can see the intersection, you can see the point of intersection. Let me lower the dimension because I want to do an application for you. And now we're in 4 space, and I'll label it this way, and we'll see why in a moment. I have changed the parameterization slightly. These things should not disturb people like you who are experts in linear algebra. So now in 4 space, we need 3 points to represent the line, and here is one, and there is another one. And all the equations are expressed in terms of a single parameter t, and here's the axis. And again, we want to see if these two lines may intersect. It's the same idea. We take the points with the same subscripts and join them. T1 with T1, T2 with T2, T3 with T3, and they all hit the parameter axis at the same value. And that tells us these two lines intersect. Now let's interpret. Let's say that we have an airplane flying in 3 space with constant velocity. Its complete trajectory information is given by 3 such points. Say this point represents the time x1 relationship. And the slope of that is nothing but the first velocity component. And the same thing, px2, px3. So this tells us this plane is going narrowly its way with constant velocity. And this thing tells us about another one. And what does the picture tell us? Is that they collide at this time and in this position. Collision, of course, being that they go through the same point at the same time. So we can see time-space position. Hopefully it doesn't happen very often. But what does happen always is if we have two lines in n space for any dimension, there's always a minimum distance between them. Okay, so when they don't intersect, we will, of course, have a gap. And it turns out, this is a nice theorem, which we won't go into it, from the gap, we can tell the minimum distance. And it's a useful thing. So together with this idea and some other ones, about 20 years or so ago, there was a competition in the US for awarding the contract for the new air traffic control system. And I was then working with the International Brotherhood of Magicians, otherwise known as IBM, then it was true. Anyway, so we were, IBM and Hughes were the ones left in the competition, and the FAA kept raising their requirements. So the requirement that they wanted for the last phase of the project was they wanted an algorithm that would do automatic collision avoidance. Now, the fact that this problem is actually NP prime did not stop the government from making it a requirement, but anyway. So we handled that, and they gave us, I mean, came up with something, and they gave us a whole bunch of really nasty scenarios, real or imaginary, I don't know. And they wanted to see what the algorithm would do. I just want to show you one of them. It's kind of fun. Actually, I have more, but time is of the essence here, so I just want to give you a taste. Okay, so here we have an air sector defined by this polygon, and we have six aircraft, the centers of these little circles, all flying at the same altitude with constant velocity, and the objective is not just to prevent collision, but to maintain a minimum separation, which is indicated by the diameter of the circle. So it would be nice if they would fly, the circles could touch but not overlap, because obviously then it was would violate the requirement. So let me show you the original, the actual situation, and it doesn't want to move. Well, we have to skip that. Doesn't stand away.
It's gone.
Okay, so here's the time in seconds. So I was amazed to see that these two guys hit each other head on, and this guy hits the other guy from the back. It must have been really spectacular watching something like that. But what was interesting to me was that in the room that was showing that, there were a bunch of air traffic controllers, the people who try and resolve these things. And let me just stop it here. And I asked them, you know, what would you do? And everybody said six aircraft is a lot, which amazed me. And only one actually attempt to resolve, and we'll get a feeling of what it means to resolve in a moment. And that was done by removing two of the most troublesome aircraft from this scenario. Unbeknownst to him, I was timing him. It took me about 12 minutes. It takes less than 5 minutes. But let me show you one of the 13 resolutions that the algorithm came up with, which is really cute. And there are really rather constrained maneuvers in that. There's a whole bunch of other things. Again, I'll show it to you after. Later on, for those interested, and especially Peter's brandy is going to be especially helpful. So you can see it's really a close call. It was amazing to see. So, okay. So one more example of hopefully trying to convince you that this idea, whatever it may be, has some applications. As we proceed, so we did what we saw something about lines. And the next question is, what can we do with planes? Planes are really difficult. If I can just take this, I will return, I promise. Because with lines, we can at least project n-dimensional lines down to two-dimensional planes and work with their projections and specify the line Unfortunately, with planes, even 3D, it doesn't work if you take the full plane, project it down and take another full plane, project it down, they look the same, you lost information. So, what happens when we have a bunch of points on a plane which are randomly chosen? This is what happens in represent them in travel coordinates, you get, really get a mess. So in the first three axes is a collection of randomly chosen points on a plane in 3D. And the thought that came up was, just like, at least for me, when I look at this room, I don't think of it as a set of points. It doesn't help my intuition at all. But rather, I think of it as something that's bounded by planes, which are one dimension less than itself. So the thought was, if we have an object, an n-dimensional object, let's try to represent it in terms of m minus one dimensional subsets of itself. Okay, so a plane in 3D is two dimensional. We have here points. Let's construct lines and see what we shall see. So how do we construct lines? Let me remind you. Well, we have a whole bunch of points. There's one. I would take any other one and find these two points of intersection and join them. And we did that, and something really remarkable. This. And the first time, by the way, this was done by one of my PhD students here at UCLA many years ago, John. The first time he showed it to me, I mean, I was absolutely convinced he was cheating. I said, come on, John, this is really working. Okay, so one more time. From here, from the points, to here, from the line, see? Here, for example, are two of the points, so pain and the straight line join them. It happens when we get that if and only if the original points are coplanar. So we know we are coplanar. And I look at this thing as some sort of a generalization to of transforms and what have you, but we'll put that on the side. Okay, so we know we are coplanar, but we don't have yet enough information to characterize the plane. We go back and then we do something which turns out to be a good idea. We take the first axis, translate it over by 3, and form a new coordinate system with the x2, x3 old axis, and x1 prime, and repeat the construction, get a second point. These two points turn out to completely characterize the plane, but we were having so much fun, so let's continue. So we take the x2 axis and translate it over by 3 units, form yet a third coordinate system, and a third point, and the fourth axis, the same thing, yielding 4 points. And here they are. And it turns out that these 4 points are really a very nice property. Let me enlarge it. Now, we said that we can represent lines with points, but points with two indices. Now we're saying that we can represent planes with points. Now, the lines, their equations, had two variables, and hence the two indices. The planes, their equations, have three variables, and now the points representing them have three indices. So, this is a cute property. But here are the points, they all have the same y. The horizontal distance between the first pair of points is 3 times the first coefficient of the equation of the plane. And this guy is 3 times the second coefficient. 3 turns out to be in dimensionality, and that's space, the time. And so forth. I mean, you can literally read the equation of the plane from the picture. So, of course, there is no question about loss of information, but you can also start doing some neat things. And remember the duality that I mentioned between translation and rotation. And let's see that now in higher dimension. So I have a plane, and these are the 4 points that I just described. And on the plane, I have a line, which is described by 2 points. Notice the difference, 2 indices, 3 indices. So I know these guys belong to lines, and this guy belongs to planes. And if you remember, we spoke about having 4 different coordinate systems, so I really have to put the points representing the line in each of the coordinate system, and it's a pair, so when I join them, I get 4 lines. Okay, now I want to rotate the plane about this line. Cha cha cha. Translation. Rotation. But we can see lots of things. For example, at this intersection here, the first two points coincide. So the first coefficient is zero. Here's the equation of the plane, any position. And the plane is perpendicular to one of the principal two points. And in this position, these the second of these points coincide. Making this coefficient zero. Okay, so from the picture we can pick the three positions where the plane is perpendicular. And at any stage, as we said, we can read the equation. And you can do that in n space. Same thing. Hyperplane is represented by n minus 1 points with n indices. Okay, so far we've still together. Now, hopefully we come to the more interesting part, at least for me. Oh yeah, let me switch gears. I think it'd be better to do that. And I'd like to talk a little bit about how we look at surfaces and hypersurfaces, because for us they really have more than just the geometry aspects, which are fun, but surfaces represent multivariate relations. So if we have a multivariate, if we are looking for a multivariate relation, and it can come somehow or other with the representation of the equivalent surface or even approximate representation, and if we can read properties of the surface from that, then we can say something about our problem, whether it be a data set or some other multivariate problem. So, how can we do surfaces? Let me pull that up a little bit. Okay, so here's the idea. Let's take a smooth surface in 3D, smooth enough so that it has, at every point, it has a tangent plane. So, take a point, I take the tangent plane, and now we have seen that every plane can be represented by two points with two different sets of indices. So, from this tangent plane, I get two points, two indices, and I do that for every point here. So I eventually collect all points with these indices in one region, and all points with these indices in another region. We're not quite done. The two regions don't yet give us the full representation of plane, because we need what might be called a matching algorithm, so that when I pick a point in here, it will tell me what point I need to pick over here, so that together these two points will enable me to construct a tangent plane. Now the business of the linking should not surprise us at all. We have that all the time. I mean, when you look at engineering drawings and say this is the projection on the x1, x2 plane, and this is the projection on the x2, x3 plane, they're linked. You have to link these things to get the complete. So this is just another kind of linking. But there is an essential difference in the representation of the surface, and we will see, hopefully in a moment, that it's a good thing. Because in this representation, in addition to having the information on the point, we also have the normal vector. Because if we know the tangent plane, we know the normal vector. That's the set of coefficients, okay? So that turns out to give us all kinds of nice information. So let's look at examples. We'll look, first of all, an example of developable surfaces. Developable surfaces are those that can be generated by from a plane without distorting it. And one can prove that the regions for developable surfaces are simply curves. So here's such a developable surface having a line of cusps. And the line of cusps, believe it or not, is represented by the two inflection points. Another duality. And from this picture, you can really reconstruct this guy. And again, we can play. Interactivity is a fun thing. So we open the leaves here more, as in this picture. And now one can imagine a plane tangent to both of the limbs, okay? That's called a bitangent, and it's represented by a crossing point and another duality. Okay, well, three such curves of these properties represent the equivalent of this pre-Chern formula, which I wouldn't have to fuck this notion to work with, and n minus 1 n d. And if you collect and do fun things. Okay, so far for developables, not surprisingly, are easy. Then the next class that we thought of are the ruled surfaces, those that can be generated by the continuous motion of a line. And we can, it's easy to show that the regions we get from there always have straight lines. This is just an example. But let's look at really my favorite ruled surface. That's the Mobius strip. Everybody knows what the Mobius strip is. Spent many happy moments with it. And you want to see what it looks like in parallel coordinates? Look at this fantastic, beautiful work. It even impressed my children. And I want to tell you, it is very difficult to impress children in our days, at least for me. And I was showing it to some of my geometry friends. And let me remind you again of the cusp inflection point duality. And this suggests something which I think is intuitively okay. That when we take a piece of paper and twist it and join it, we are creating an inflection point in 3D. Now, we can see non-orientability in a semi-clever way. If we take a Mobius strip, if we just take a Mobius strip and lay it down, it'll always have three folds. And I looked at that and I said, why does it remind me of something? And it turns out this is where the symbol for recycling comes from. That was a great idea, because now what better recycles itself? Well, but it kind of cheats when it recycles, because it has these three folds always. And so in this position, let's say that this is the x2, x3 plane that it's on. So in this position, the tangent plane is perpendicular. So if I take a closed loop, which I did, and plot it in parallel coordinates, I get a crossing, just like I showed you. And then I get one more crossing, and get one more crossing. And it's very easy to prove that every time it goes through such a thing, the sign of the coefficient changes. So C1 changes sign three times. C2 changes sign three times. C3 changes sign three times. So by the time it gets back to here, to the same point, the normal is minus, and we get the non-orientability. Now, if I had six crossings, I know that I had two loops. I have some ideas about higher dimensional generalization. If anybody likes to share their ideas, I'd like to know. But when I started looking up higher dimensional generalizations of that, I got into string theory and all kinds of things, and I felt slightly uncomfortable. Okay, now I'm wrapping up. It's still a little time. This is a picture for a sphere centered at the origin. And I translated it a little bit. And again, we have the rotation translation duality. And it is interesting because the blue hyperbolic region rotates clockwise, and the other one counterclockwise. But by the way, the same way as the cube, did I show you the cube? I should have shown you. The sphere in phi space is four such regions, n space, n minus one such region. And then I looked at general convex surfaces, and I think this is a very nice result, and I saw several people struggling with convex functions. This may be of interest to you guys. People, guys means it's a generic. Okay, this is a convex surface, and it has hyperbolic-like regions. Hyperbolic in the sense the regions always have asymptotes. It turns out, in any dimension, if you see just hyperbolic regions in one orientation that guarantees complexity, which is very a whole bunch of problems. But it's also enjoyable because I said, okay, let's screw it up. And I worked a little bit hard to with the equations to put in a bump just to see what it would do. And of course, immediately, so it wasn't convex. But there are other ways to screw up convexity. So I took something like a balloon and I put dimples. There is one section, put three. And they show up as swirls, something that you couldn't possibly see in the ordinary way that we represent objects. But we see it here. I want to remind you, because we are representing the surface not just by its point, but also by the normal vector of each one of its points. And it catches all these features, which is very useful, even in 3D. And I kept pushing my luck and looked at such things, which are very beautiful. And again, there are the invariances here, which carry no orientations, which we can investigate. Another thing that I looked at, which I think would be especially useful to some of the applications that I saw here, is the following idea. We have a plane, even in 3D. To remind you, we can represent it by a pair of points, same y. Now, what happens if I play around with the plane? Or better yet, if I take the equation of the plane and I allow the coefficients to vary in intervals, it generates a family of planes, which at least in some intuitive sense are close. So I wanted to see, well, I tried very hard to visualize such a family in 3D. Kind of see it, but it's hard. But I did it numerically. I said, I'll take an equation, and I'll let the coefficients vary in intervals. And I will just compute the pair of points and collect them. Two convex hexagons, provable. And if I also allow translations that become octagons, in n space, it's n minus 1, 2 n n-agons. Convex, you can work with. From this picture, you can recover the complete information. You can recover, again, how it's done. These are details about the deviations in each and every direction. And it gives, believe it or not, a nice topology for flats. You can generate neighborhoods in terms of these creatures that have nice topological properties, so that you can speak in some semi-intelligent way about proximity of lines, of planes, of hyperplanes, of flats, things that are important, I believe, in lots of applications. Okay, so I think that was enough, but not yet. I want to show you something semi-amusing, at least to me, and some other people. Also going back to data, because we were supposed to be doing something with data. By the way, I have lots of data sets that we can explore, and I proposed after the 4 p.m. Randy session, whoever is interested, we can sit down. You can also bring your data, we'll look at it, see what we shall see. Okay, I was in a Latin American country, and I was working with the Banco Central, and they gave me data on their economy. And the data consisted of the output of various sectors of the economy. The agricultural sector, fishing, mining, manufacturing, construction, government, which was budget, other budgets, and GNP. So they gave me data for many years, and I did the least case. I fitted it. You guys know how to fit this. It's probably better than I do. But it gave me an eight-dimensional hypersurface that looks like that. Now, of course, it's a simplistic idea, it's a simple model, blah, blah, blah. But it's something. So in some sense, this is a visual model for the economy of the country. So, and that's a hypersurface. So an interior point to it should represent a feasible economic policy. So let's play around and see if we can decide. Okay, so that what I'm doing now, okay, I will just take one of the variables. Let's take the agricultural output. Let's say that we're trying, this is the allowable range for the agricultural output. And what you're seeing here is actually the output of the interior point algorithm. So what it's saying is the following. With whatever value it chooses of the agricultural output, it shows me what are the available ranges for the remaining variables where I have to be in order to stay interior, which makes sense. After all, these variables are related, so if you put a constraint in one, you are affecting the other guys. So let's say we want a policy with high agriculture. And we go to fishing, we go into any other variable, but I want to show something that came up. So that was very curious. High fishing, low mining, and kind of vice versa, which was peculiar. But I didn't take it seriously. I said, well, what would you expect from a simplistic model? But one of the people in the bank actually went back and looked at it, and he wrote me back an enthusiastic email. Says, Alfredo, we found something fundamental. I said, what's going on? Really an interesting thing. Unbeknownst to them, these two sectors were competing for pretty much the same group of workers. There's a large group of migrant workers. When the fishing is good, they come down from the mountain to work on the fishing boats. And there aren't enough of them left to work the mines. And vice versa. That's why in all the data that they gave me, everything that you could see was either, never saw a year where they both did well or they both did bad. So it was fascinating, at least to me, that something of some interest. By the way, you could spot, it's also fun for spotting sensitivities and doing trade-off analysis. Let's say this is now an interior point, which in principle is an economic policy, so you could wiggle it around and see if I lose here somewhere, would I gain it? And it is something that I think non-technical people can do and use for decision-making, hopefully making better decisions than the ones we have seen by certain politicians in recent times. But I want to finish with the important message, hopefully, is contained here. Okay, thank you very much.